This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy. People, I'm going to ask you to take my word for this. We history guys, we speak the truth. And yet, there's a good chance you don't believe a word that I'm saying right now. A study last year by the Pew Research Center found that only about a quarter of Americans believe all or most of what they hear on NPR.
And NPR, we should point out, is not alone. Almost every newspaper and TV news outlet ranked even lower. But here's the interesting part. When the surveyors divvied up respondents by political affiliation, they found that Democrats were twice as likely as Republicans to find NPR credible. The same was true in reverse for Fox News.
For a lot of you, this will no doubt come as deeply depressing news. After all, if we're only seeking out news that fits our own worldviews, and Lord knows we have more choices all the time, what hope does CBS, NBC, the New York Times ever have of surviving? And if they don't survive, what will be left in their wake but opinion mongers, public relations professionals, cable news shouters? And so today, we history guys will do what we always do in the face of future uncertainty. That's to turn to the past. We thought it might be useful, dare I say even reassuring, to look at the origins of this thing so many fear may be on its last legs. Objective, just the facts, good old-fashioned reporting. It, like everything else, has a history, and today we're going to try and uncover some of that history.
We'll start back in my century, the 18th century, the 1790s to be exact. News reporting hadn't been invented yet, and up until that point, the press had consisted of individual printers whose job it was to compile information, shipping timetables, legal notices, and put it all into print. They called themselves editors, but really, their role was to be impartial and not to inject any of their own ideas into their papers. But in the 1790s, all that was beginning to change.
Professions of impartiality, I will make none. They are always useless and are besides a perfect nonsense when used by a newsmonger.
Those are the words of William Cobbett, otherwise known as Peter Porcupine, editor of the Porcupine's Gazette, one of Philadelphia's most popular and, shall we say, aggressive newspapers.
He that does not exercise his own judgment, either in admitting or rejecting what is sent to him, is a poor passive tool and not an editor. For my part, I feel the strongest partiality for the cause of order and good government such as we live under, and against everything that is opposed to it.
Order and good government. Who could argue with that? Well, as it turns out, a whole lot of politicians could. Because to Cobbett, partisanship in favor of good government meant writing about elected officials, warts and all, and exposing them for the weak-willed, hypocritical, two-faced egomaniacs that they were. Federalists, Republicans, they were all fair game. It's all detailed in a new book called Scandal and Civility by historian Marcus Daniel. A little while ago, he told me about some of his favorite Cobbett screeds.
One of my favorites is his attack on John Swanwick, who was a Philadelphia congressman in the 1790s, where he calls him a little omiculo. This is a reference to his sort of diminutive sexual talents. Swanwick advocates women's education, and Cobbett assails him for going around lecturing young women about education, basically accusing him of sort of indulging his own perverse sexual appetites in the course of, you know, what seems like a good deed.
Well, one of the things I like about your book, Marcus, is that you make it clear that this isn't gratuitous. This is not just political porn for the sake of entertainment value. People are really anxious during this period, and they've got good reasons to be anxious.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think there's a deep sense of concern within the political class about what the relationship is going to be with the people that has been created by the American Revolution and the passage of the Constitution. And citizens themselves are concerned about their political representatives and about how to identify men who are worthy of their vote, who are worthy of political responsibility. And the question is, how do you determine that? And I think this is where the press and figures like Cobbett become a crucial intermediary. And that takes them into the private lives of these public figures, because there's a sort of widespread sense, and I think this is something that still characterizes our politics today, that politicians don't always tell the truth, that they construct a public persona that isn't in accord with their true inner motivations and impulses. And the sense in which this scandal mongering is serious is that it is an attempt to pierce that veil, to get behind the public persona, and to make it clear to citizens the true nature of the men that are competing for their favor and for their vote.
So democracy, to really work under these new conditions, you had to have this kind of very personal, interrogatory, challenging kind of journalism,
yes,
which often did push beyond acceptable and respectable boundaries.
I think that's right.
What I wonder, though, is we have a pretty robust and sometimes vituperative and nasty press today. Is it doing democratic work? Would you make that parallel?
I'm rather torn. I mean, this is something I wrestle with. I'm not entirely antagonistic to some of the journalistic populists of the present day. I think there is a sense in which they are speaking to a sort of broad audience in its own terms. The difference between Fox News and William Cobbett, between a figure like Bill O'Reilly and William Cobbett perhaps, is that Cobbett was very much a one-man show. The journalists during this period are not working for large corporations. They don't have a lot of economic muscle behind them. They're very much individuals running their own printing shops and their own newspapers and calling the shots themselves. And they value and prize that sense of independence and autonomy greatly. And it really shapes their work as well. I think there's an important relationship between the economic independence that they have during this period and the independence of their political voices. And that's something that's really changed now. And a figure like Cobbett, I think, is closer to some of the right-wing bloggers who set up their own website and managed to build an audience for that through self-publicization. And that's what Cobbett is up to,
right.
And I think the other political journalists of the period as well.
Well, Marcus, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great talking to you.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Marcus Daniel is a history professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and the author of the brand new book, Scandal and Civility, Journalism and the Birth of American Democracy.
So that was a very cheerful view of things that people worry about a lot. Partisanship, ad hominem attacks, scandal and gossip.
Yeah.
You know, Peter, in
yeah.
the spirit
yeah.
of his argument, I want to argue with you for not arguing with him.
Oh, man, did I let the side down?
No,
well,
I just didn't
want to replicate the vituperative politics that we were talking about.
Yeah.
And that would lead to my major point about this, Ed and Brian. And that is, it depends on where you're sitting, how you feel about this. And in retrospect of a couple of hundred years, you say, yeah, this works, doesn't it? But if you were, for instance, Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, who was trashed by the press in the end of his second term, you might have in the abstract the idea that this kind of give and take is good, but you wouldn't want to be there.
Yeah, Peter, but, you know, forgive me if I got my 18th century history wrong here. Didn't Jefferson start the opposition press?
Well, the unequivocal answer to that is yes and no. I think the great thing about Jefferson is that you get everything you want from him, both sides. If you want one of the great quotations in the history of the free press and American journalism, you just turn to a letter that he wrote to Edward Carrington in 1787, and I'm going to give it in Jeffersonian intonations here. Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Right.
So that's fine when he's not president. What happens when he becomes president, when he's being criticized, let's say, for his policy on trade embargo or whatever?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things that he'll do. First, he'll use libel proceedings on the state level to go after seditious speech, people who are besmirching his name. And of course, you must be aiming to subvert the republic if you attack the administration. The second thing is really interesting. He tries to enforce a kind of Jefferson consensus speak on his supporters. There's a letter he writes to James Duane in 1811 after he stepped down as president. Duane is one of these editors that Marcus writes about. And he says this. He says, "The Republicans are the nation. The Republicans are the nation. The nation must be united." That's how I'm paraphrasing now. "And therefore, it's incumbent on the leaders of Republican opinion in the press to rally together, lest we create openings for our enemies, because those openings could lead to the destruction of the republic."
Wow. So, Peter, when you quote, "the Republicans are the nation," you mean capital R Republicans as Republican Party, meaning
you got it. Yeah.
That those Federalist guys, they're like, not even Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty radical. That's a pretty radical brew.
Does that sound sort of 20th century to you?
I mean, it sounds McCarthy. It sounds beyond the 20th century, Peter.
It sounds 21st century.
Yeah.
It should be pointed out that he always said that the antidote to a scurrilous press was the truth. And he presented this as if the truth is, and I think he's actually deluded on this, he doesn't understand what he's saying, is that the truth somehow will come out and vanquish the lies that editors promulgate. And of course, it's only through other editors that the truth is going to get out. Mm-hmm. Leaving that aside, he did live long enough to actually say some things that newspaper people like. Let me leave you with a quotation that will make you and our editorial friends happy today. "The only security of all," he writes in 1823 to Lafayette, "the only security of all is in a free press. The force of public opinion cannot be resisted when permitted freely to be expressed. The agitation it produces must be submitted to. It is necessary to keep the waters pure."
Oh, that's so cool. So if we live in a world of Disney movies where the endings are all that matter, then Jefferson truly is a champion of the press.
That's right, Brian. And if you out there in Radio Land would like to read more about what Jefferson had to say about the press, and there's the good, bad, and the ugly, we've got a link to a whole slew of his quotes on our website, backstoryradio.org. This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I'm Peter Runoff, your guide to the 18th century.
I'm Ed Ayers, your guide to the 19th century.
And I'm Brian Ballow, fearless guide to the 20th century.
Get your Morning Star, read all about it, morning paper, paper mister.
We're talking today about the history of the American news media, and particularly the media values that we hold dear. In the first part of the show, we heard how the new political realities of the late 18th century ushered in a new role for the press as a sort of check on political power. Editors started to find their voice and to use it to offer up their opinions about political life. At the beginning, those editors were independent operators, but before long, they had formed coalitions with one another, coalitions that became the backbone of the party system we still have today.
As for the newspapers themselves, well, they still left something to be desired. There was still no news reporting, per se. Instead, the papers basically consisted of partisan editorials mixed in with all kinds of commercial information, commodity prices, articles about international finance. That's because they catered to the merchant class, which was evidenced by their cover price of 6 cents.
Whoa.
Yeah, way more than most people could afford. And so in 1833, along comes a New York printer by the name of Benjamin Day with the idea of putting out a paper for ordinary working folks. His paper, The Sun, would be filled with stories he thought would interest them. Sports, local gossip, crime, and best of all, it would only cost 1 cent. The so-called penny press was born, and the paper sold like hotcakes, especially when, a couple of years into its existence, The Sun ran a 6-part series about a most fascinating news event.
Life had been discovered on the moon, including sheep and hairy bison.
That's Matthew Goodman, author of a new book entitled The Sun and the Moon.
As these articles went along, the creatures that were discovered became ever stranger and more remarkable. It turns out that unicorns were discovered on the moon, and biped beavers who walk on their hind legs and had discovered the secret of fire. And most remarkable of all, kind of the crowning glory of the series, were these lunar man-bats, 4-foot-tall man-bats, Vespertilio Homo, John Herschel was supposed to have dubbed them, who talked and flew and built temples and did art and apparently fornicated in public, although that was something the Sun didn't go into too many details about.
Goodman told me that the hoax was the brainchild of the Sun's editor, Richard Adams Locke. Now, Locke was an abolitionist in a time when very few New Yorkers were, an all-around political radical. He was especially concerned that mainstream science was being overrun by religion. Influential astronomers, for example, believed that the Sun, Moon, and stars were inhabited. Because why would God have created them without intelligent forms of life to put on them?
Locke thought this was nonsense, and he set out to write a satire of these ideas. You know, he said, well, if you believe in an inhabited moon, I'll give you an inhabited moon. And if you believe that the creatures on the moon are Christians, I will give you lunar man bats who build lunar temples. And garb it all in this sort of high-flown language used by the religious astronomers, and in so doing, expose it for the humbug that it is. But what he hadn't anticipated, and this is really the crux of the story, is that people had been so schooled in the ideas of these religious astronomers that when the articles appeared, they simply believed them. They believed that they were true. And people, you know, swarmed around the Sun offices waiting for the next installment. And after people discovered that the Sun series was a hoax, they didn't turn against the Sun, as we might suspect that they did, and as many of the Sun's rivals of the time predicted that they would. Really, I guess the best indication of how popular the series was that by the time the series was over, the Sun had become the most widely read newspaper in the entire world.
Wow. Now, you used the word humbug. It's interesting that this is the exact same moment and place where P.T. Barnum emerges and
that's right
and flourishes. But what is it about America and New York in the 1830s that seems to foster this sort of thing?
That's a very interesting question. This was really the age of hoaxes. Barnum would very quickly become, you know, rich and arguably the most famous American in the world on the back of his hoaxes. Because part of what was going on, and I guess this is in some sense an answer to your question, this was really a democratizing era. You know, Andrew Jackson was in the White House at the time. You were beginning to see the falling away of a lot of the venerable traditions of the old world. You know, cartmen didn't doff their hats to their employers anymore. People called each other Mr. rather than Sir. Shaking hands instead of bowing, you know, became much more widely in use. And, of course, the political systems were being democratized. You know, in New York, you began to have direct elections of the mayor for the first time. Up to that point, he had been appointed by the governor. So this really was a democratizing time. And I think part of the appeal of hoaxes at that time was that people were beginning to understand their own right of judgment, their own right of determining what was true and what was not true. And if they were successfully fooled, they felt not cheated, they felt entertained.
Did other newspaper people take the lesson from this, that the more outrageous we can be, the better?
Well, you certainly did begin to see a taste for scandal develop among other newspapers. And by the way, very quickly after the Sun, you began to see the appearance of other penny papers in cities around the country. The New Orleans Times-Picayune began at that time.
Where the word Picayune comes from, if I'm not mistaken, why we think of something as Picayune,
that's right,
is because it was cheap, right?
It was the coin of the time, exactly. Yeah. The Cleveland Plain Dealer, all of which continue to publish today, all got their start in the wake of the success of the Sun. So, you know, these papers were really quite good in a lot of ways. They had very good, strong local coverage, which was something that had never been done before. People really began to understand a lot more of what was going on in the, you know, the life around them. You began to see the merchant papers begin to change their coverage as well. So they began to have more crime coverage. They began to publish, you know, more gossip, more entertainment, and so forth. And they also began to develop the same selling techniques as the Sun, which was the use of newsboys. Up to that point, newspapers had been sold only by subscription. You know, the editors of the merchant papers thought it was beneath them. It was ungentlemanly to try to hawk your paper on the street, you know, with ragamuffins. But the Sun's fleet of newsboys were so successful that the other papers realized that they had to sort of catch up and do the same thing themselves. But it was unsuccessful. And really, within about 15 or 20 years, you really see the end of the old line merchant newspapers. The sixpenny papers had virtually disappeared by the 1850s.
Now, it's hard not to see this in some ways as a decline, right? We go from newspapers that are disciplined, global, you know, information-filled, above scandal and above just making stuff up. And these new newspapers come along and they drag the mainstream press down with them. Give me a counter story so I won't go off into the day feeling so depressed by this.
I think there were good things about it, and I think there were bad things about it. I mean, part of what happened was that, yes, you could argue that there were some diminishing of standards perhaps, but at the same time, you began to see a far more literate public, a public that was far more able to understand what was going on in the society around them as a result of these newspapers. So there were some negative aspects of this democratizing of the press and of the culture, but there were certainly quite a lot of positive aspects as well.
And very interesting to think about, too, that we touched briefly on abolitionism, to think about abolitionism and hoaxes coming out of the same democratizing culture. Right? You could argue that slavery might not come to an end if the merchant newspapers had been left to their own devices. You know,
well, the merchant newspapers were big pro-slavery papers.
Yeah, exactly.
They really were, because they were absolutely wrapped up in the cotton trade. So they had an economic interest in preserving it.
Well, the book is fascinating, and I'm really grateful both for the book and for your time talking with us today.
Oh, thank you. It was really fun. I appreciate it.
Matthew Goodman is the author of The Sun and the Moon, the remarkable true account of hoaxers, showmen, dueling journalists, and lunar mad bats in 19th century New York. We'll link to his own summary of the book at backstoryradio.org.
Wow, man bats. I don't know. You think a paper could pull that off today? At a minimum, it'd have to be person bats, right?
It strikes me that every time I go to the supermarket, I see people pulling it off on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, everybody's got a story, right?
Yeah.
I mean, are you going to discriminate against man bats?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, it's time to go to the phones to get us out of this bat trap here. As we do with each of our show topics, we've been fielding your comments on this week's topic on our website, and our producers have invited a few of you commentators to join us on the phone.
Hey, guys, we got a call from New Paltz, New York. It's Jeremiah on the line. Jeremiah, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you. I'm very interested in the role the wire services might have played in getting us this far, or however far you want to say.
Yeah. All right. So the question is, how do the wire services transform the press? And happily, we didn't have wire services in the 18th century.
And we had them for a long time in the 20th century. So that leaves only one person, Ed.
Oh, the fingers are pointing right at the 19th century, the meat of American history here. Well, the wire services emerge just in time, really, for the American Civil War. The telegraph begins to sort of knit the country together in the 1840s, really picks up in the 1850s. And until you have this sort of network of telegraphs covering the whole country, the idea of a wire service doesn't really make sense. Then you have suddenly the Civil War, where there's all of this news just being generated in enormous amounts every day, and people are desperate to hear what they can as fast as they can. So you start having these very, so to speak, telegraphic kinds of reports coming across that are very terse and, you know, just the facts.
Didn't the fact of the wire being transmitted and so on in terms of stories, didn't that contribute to, if not actually create the need for the inverted pyramid? Which is to say the front-loaded Jack Webbian kind of boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, so Jeremiah, tell us more about that front-loaded and inverted pyramid.
What I've always understood is that that was how the classic objective lead in a news story happened, because transmission lines went down. and during the Civil War went down quite often, apparently, so that the reporters were intent on getting the facts out very efficiently, as quickly as possible. And rather than going into the kind of flowery prose that, you know, was kind of the style of the day and stuff, they just kind of punch it out and take, you know, the flowery stuff would happen at the bottom, if it happened at all.
That sounds entirely plausible to me, in the sense that, you know, and if just having read a lot of these things, you know, sitting down in front of the microfilm machine and reading the actual old newspapers, you can see that at the transmitting end, a person says, here's my chance to tell them what happened at Gettysburg, right? So you send out literally this very telegraphic message that gets the punchline out first. And then as you have more time, you fill in behind it.
And Jeremiah, so, I just want to add something else, guys. I mean, stop me if I'm wrong, but I think the way these telegraph wires were used was to transmit basic data on the price of commodities, on the price of stock. And so to get back to the larger point of perception here, I think people begin to think of the news a little bit more in terms of just what Jeremiah was talking about. Let's get the really bare essentials out first.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much for calling.
My pleasure.
Great talking to you,
Jeremiah. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the history of American news media values. And you know, guys, speaking of values, I'd say Jeremiah's call lands us squarely at the doorstep of what is probably the most dominant media value of the last century, and that's objectivity. That really takes off at the beginning of the 20th century, don't you guys agree?
You know, it's interesting because you look at this and you try to figure out what role does technology play in it. And it's clear, you know, that getting immediate uniform news all across the United States, this brand new network of telegraphs, is something new and really cool and important. And it does, at the beginning, cause people to be much more concise and to just get the facts out there. But, you know, it strikes me that just because the telegraph is new, I think the idea of objectivity and the facts is not new, isn't that right?
Well, I would say that absolutely. I think you can go way back, Ed, to the first great place in which you have a lot of information exchanged, where reliability and trustworthiness is important, and that's in the marketplace. Because, you know, markets, they sound like abstractions to us. What is a market? It used to be an actual place where people get together and exchange things and face-to-face transactions, but it became mediated, and that is, it became long distance, and you had to have reliable information. And the early media were really driven by the need for that information about prices current in different places in the world so that entrepreneurs could make decisions and choices in the marketplace. Now, you would say there's a lot of fraud going on. You'd say that's the explanation of what's happened in the last year or so. And I would agree with you. But it's that need to believe that there could be something objective that's fundamental. And it goes back to the beginning of market relationships.
Yeah, Peter, you know, that is such a good point. And it sets up the two other pieces we have to put on the table to explain the rise of this objective ideal. One is social science and the belief in expertise, which really begins to go hog wild at the end of Ed's century, beginning of the 20th century. And why is it that people are turning to these experts? It's because this old model of trust, believing in one's character, that handshake is beginning to break down because of the number of transactions and the distance at which those transactions are occurring. Mm-hmm. So increasingly, people want the facts. They want numbers. It's not enough for a man to simply be of good character. They want to see the data. Mm-hmm. And the newspapers are really carrying that.
Right.
And what's more, those outlets, those big newspapers, for the first time are able to appeal to a big enough market, a large enough readership, so that they can begin to separate themselves from the political parties, to be relatively independent, not to be lockstep Republican or lockstep Democrat. Not that they don't have their preferences, but they don't depend on those printing contracts as much. They don't depend on the political parties as much.
It's interesting, the marriage of this new objectivity and this new political independence is something that our listeners will remember from high school class called muckraking, right? The idea there in the Muckrakers, if you could just lay out the truth, if you could display in the full light of public perception the hidden deals and cut corners and corruption that underlay things, that it would be corrected.
But it turned out, Ed, that those muckrakers were great writers, and they had lots of salacious details. So they were able to bring together the man-bats and the truth.
Mm. So beautifully put, Brian. I can never hear that kind of equation often enough. the man-bats and the truth. Yeah, you're right, because you remember the example of the most successful muckraking, Upton Sinclair, The Jungle. And his famous phrase was, "I aim for people's minds and I hit them in the stomach." And what people fixated on in his book, The Jungle, is, yuck, that's how they make hot dogs? Rather than, look at the injustice inflicted upon these working people. So in order for you to expose injustice, you kind of have to have this scandalous tone, which kind of pulls away from objectivity. So the point being, we're never going to have a completely objective media because we don't really want one.
Right.
We want man bats.
Another thing we want is another break. When we get back, Slate founder Michael Kinsley will tell us why the internet does not spell the end for high-quality news reporting.